Clark Forge. My conscience stings, and I've just changed into my riding skirt and cloak to go after Lydia. She can't have gotten far. When there is a pounding at the door, huge fists pummel the wooden timbers. I can see them shake from 10 feet away. When I pull it open, John Cowan stands at the threshold, stomping his boots on the flagstone to knock off the snow. He takes in my attire, nodding once in approval.
Good, he says. You're ready.
For what?
To ride.
It takes a moment. My mind is elsewhere, and I wasn't expecting the young blacksmith's apprentice, so it's a full 5 seconds before I realize one of the clerks needs my help.
Which one of them is ill?
I ask over my shoulder as I go to get my medical bag.
Mary,
he says, then adds,
the baby. She's been having fits.
John Cowan has not bothered with the wagon this time, having instead ridden Charles Clark's draft horse, Samson, better suited for the plow. He looks ridiculous with a tiny saddle on his broad back, as though someone has tacked a square of leather to a Highland steer. He stamps at the gate, impatient.
Let me get Brutus and we can leave. No need, your husband's already gone for him.
How?
I passed the mill on my way in, told him you'd been summoned.
And sure enough, he has. For no sooner do I reach the garden gate than Ephraim comes down the path from the barn, leading Brutus. If he is sorry for his harsh words, he doesn't show it. He simply helps me into the saddle and wishes us well as we head for the lane. I look back once, hoping to meet his eyes, but he's already turned back to the mill. I can handle being out of sorts with half the town, but this, Ephraim's disappointment, pains me. Sorting that out will have to wait, however. At a full gallop, it takes less than 10 minutes to reach the forge, and then John leads the horses to the barn for water and hay while I make my way to the house. I can hear Betsy Clark crying from the other side of the door, but still I knock, to be polite. Sometimes people would rather keep their tears to themselves. It's a choice I always try to give when possible. Charles opens the door with one hand, and I see that he is holding the baby snug in the crook of his other arm. They both exhale in relief when they see me.
Come in, he says, please.
I shed my riding cloak, set my bag on the floor. What's wrong?
It started last night, Betsy says. At first, I thought it was just a shudder. You know how they do sometimes when they pass water. But then she did it again. Later, and again in the middle of the night, and both those times, her hippen was dry.
It got worse this morning, Charles adds.
I take a seat beside the fire and reach for the bundle in his arms. He hands the baby to me, and I set her in my lap, head at my knees, feet against my belly, so I can unwrap the blanket. Mary Clark is still scrawny, but she's gotten longer and fills my entire lap now. When was her last fit? I ask. Betsy sniffles, wipes her wet cheeks with the back of her hand.
An hour ago, right before we sent John.
The cabin is warm, and the baby doesn't protest when her swaddle is fully removed. There are no signs of injury, no lumps, no bruises. She looks at me with large, round eyes as I run my hands across her body. I feel her legs and back, arms. I prod her torso gently and move my fingers up the side of her neck, around her ears. Has she fallen, perhaps off the bed? The baby is too young to roll over, but falling happens sometimes, accidentally.
No!
I press my fingers lightly against the base of her little skull. Temples, crown. There doesn't seem to be any swelling. Has she been dropped? Perhaps by one of the girls? Betsy shakes her head. Have they carried her to you? Maybe once when she was crying or just around the bedroom and you didn't know. She hesitates, looks at Charles.
I'll go ask, he says,
and slips into the bedroom where their other two daughters are playing quietly out of the way, as they've been instructed.
They would never,
Betsy whispers. It wouldn't have been on purpose. Charles comes out a moment later.
Neither of them dropped her, they swear on it.
And you're certain they're telling the truth?
Yes, both of them are terrible liars.
He almost smiles.
They get it from their mother. None of them have a talent for it.
I'm finished with my examination when it happens again. Little Mary Clark goes stiff and still in my lap. Then there is a sudden jerking of muscles. Her eyes roll back until I can see the whites. Betsy wails. Charles curses. And I hold the child's head in one hand and reach into her mouth to make sure she hasn't swallowed her tongue and blocked her airway. She hasn't, so I pull her tight against my chest. I can feel all 9 pounds of her quivering against my ribs. 45 seconds. That's how long the seizure lasts. And when it is over, Mary doesn't cry. Her face is placid, and her eyes look to the ceiling, unfocused.
I don't think this was caused by any injury, I say. What then? Charles asks. It is strange to hear the voice of a big man crack in fear.
I think I know, but I cannot be sure, and I don't want to share my opinion yet. If I'm correct, this is a disease I've never treated, a disease that might not even be treatable.
Go fetch John for me, I tell Charles.
He hesitates, curious, but does as he's told, and is soon back with his apprentice in tow. He's been at the anvil and wears a heavy leather apron. Sweat beads his brow.
Mistress Ballard?
He asks.
Is Samson still saddled? I ask.
No.
Then you can take Brutus, but be careful, I say, noting his startled expression. He bites, and he's thrown every rider that's ever sat him. If you value your life, do not pull too hard at the reins.
John Cowan swallows once.
Where am I taking him?
To Burnt Hill. I need you to bring Doctor back with you.
I did not think she made house calls.
John looks at the baby, back at me.
I was told you have to go to her, and I do not think that Mary...
He doesn't want to say it aloud, and I do not blame him. Then let us see if she will make an exception. Tell her that Martha Ballard begs that she come with you.
It takes almost 2 hours before we hear pounding horse hooves. John escorts Doctor through the door with a kind of dazed expression I'd expect of a man who's just been strapped to the top of a carriage and driven off a cliff. I felt much the same way the first time I rode Brutus at full tilt.
Please come in, Charles says, motioning Doctor forward. I'll help John with the horses.
It's been too much for Charles. He paced while his wife nursed the baby. He paced while I changed her hippen. He paced the entire time we waited. At one point, he tried to give me the fee for the child's birth, now overdue. But I'd refused, curling his fingers back over the coins and telling him to pay Doctor instead. He paced then, too, afraid of what that meant. So this task, the managing of beasts, is a relief to him. It is a thing he can do. And like all men, that is where his instinct goes.
Just do something and fix it if you damn well can, the mind of a man screams.
By and large, they are useless at a time like this. And it is a relief to all of us when both Charles and John are gone. Betsy relaxes, as does Doctor. Her riding cloak goes on the hook beside mine, and she takes a seat with us.
Her name is Mary, I say, handing over the tiny bundle. The fits started yesterday.
Doctor lays the baby on her lap, exactly as I had, but is far more cautious. She turns to Betsy and asks,
May I look at her?
I am aware that this is a permission I never thought to ask.
Of course,
Betsy says. Only once she's been granted approval does Doctor strip the child naked and begin her examination. It is a fascinating thing to watch. She looks for injuries, as I had, pokes and prods in all the same places. But then she turns the baby onto her forearm and runs the pad of her index finger all the way up her spine and back down again, checking for deformities in every vertebra. And all the while, Doctor whispers to herself,
Several minutes into this, Betsy leans toward me.
What is she saying?
I shrug. I don't speak French. Doctor's voice is deep and calming, and soon the whispers turn into song, a lullaby of some sort, hummed as she bends her ear to the baby's chest, listens to her breath. I can see Doctor count each heartbeat with a tap of her finger. The next seizure is not so violent as the last, but still, Betsy jerks in her chair as though she has been stung by a wasp. It may be a thing that she never grows comfortable with. Doctor, however, remains calm as Mary twitches in her lap. She holds the baby's arms down, and I hear her counting in French, though I don't know the numbers past three. Trois, quatre, cinq, six, sept, huit, neuf, dix. She keeps going until the seizure stops. Vingt-trois. When the fit is over, Doctor dresses and swaddles Mary, then hands her back to Betsy.
Give her the breast if she will take it. It is the best thing for her right now. But pull away if she has another episode.
As directed, Betsy unbuttons her blouse and puts the baby to her nipple. Mary latches on, though not as forcefully as I would like. Doctor looks at me, motions with her head.
Let us talk outside.
The snow has turned to rain, and we stand outside the cabin, unprotected from the downpour. Doctor slides back into her cloak. She pulls on her gloves. After a moment, she nods to my riding skirt.
That is very practical.
It was easy, I tell her. I can show you how to make one.
Next time, perhaps.
Charles stomps his way back from the barn. He glances at me, then hands Doctor a small leather pouch filled with coins.
Your fee, he says,
then slips inside to tend his wife and child. Doctor looks to the door where he has just disappeared.
He is a gentleman.
He is learning, I say, but do not bother her with our history. I've heard of children, adults as well, with that condition, but I don't know what it's called. I only know it as the fits.
I believe she has the falling sickness,
Doctor tells me, then adds,
epilepsia. Sometimes they grow out of it, sometimes they do not. Time will tell.
You've seen it before?
A handful of times in France. Mostly in children. Often the seizures come in clusters. Lots in a day. Or for several days in a row. Then nothing. Weeks can go by. Months before another one. If you are very lucky, they never come back after childhood.
Are they deadly?
They can be.
Is there no treatment? Nothing I can give her?
Oui. Valerian, skullcap, horseradish, in various preparations. There are other things too, but none of them grow here. And I wouldn't give them to a child regardless. These herbs might do more damage than good. She is too young.
When? How old must she be?
Doctor is unwilling to give an exact answer. Beyond childhood. If she lives that long.
Will it cause damage?
I tap my left temple with a finger.
Here?
She gives me a weak smile. I cannot say.
When I look up, Betsy Clark is at the window, Mary's little head against her shoulder, watching us. I suppose we should go tell them.
No. You will tell her. They are your friends, your patients. They called for you.
And I called for you.
Which is why I came. Otherwise, I would not have interfered.
Thank you. I do appreciate it.
I am glad to help, Doctor says. The people in this town revere you. That is why they come to me, sometimes, you know.
No. They go to you because you are more skilled. She shrugs as though the point is up for debate.
They come to me when they want to preserve your good opinion.
Not all secrets are bad, I argue.
Just because a secret isn't bad doesn't mean it's harmless. Speaking of which, how is your other patient?
The foster woman.
As poorly as you would expect, and growing ripe with child. Doctor sets one hand on my shoulder, smiles.
Bon courage.
Bon courage. Be of good courage. Courage is good, I think, wishing that I had more than a grain to spare. As Doctor walks to the barn to collect Goliath, the rain turns hard and cold, like stones tossed by an angry boy. Hail. Hell, why not make a bad day worse? Epilepsia. Epilepsy. It makes so much more sense now. I have read of this disease in 3 different Shakespeare plays, but didn't know what it meant. Brutus described Julius Caesar as having the falling sickness. Othello raged and foamed as if he had fallen into an epilepsy. And Kent told Cornwall in King Lear that he wished a plague upon your epileptic visage. Leave it to the bard to name a thing that has hitherto gone unnamed. This realization is no victory, however. I turn back to the cabin to give Betsy and Charles the news. Wednesday, February 24. Snowed and rained and hailed. I was called to see Charles Clark's daughter, who is destitute by reason of epilepsy. The Robin's Nest. Sunday, February 28.
I told Dr. Page that his services would not be required today. Mrs. Ney, the prim, gray-haired housekeeper, shuts the bedroom door behind me, adding, he was none too pleased.
I don't care what pleases him, Eliza Robbins says, breathing through her teeth, air hissing in and out as the contraction seizes her. She stands at the window, hands upon her belly. Even in travail, I can hear the sophisticated lilt of a well-bred Englishwoman. I won't let him anywhere near me.
Your husband wasn't pleased either. He called for Dr. Page, after all, Mrs. Ney chides.
She rolls her eyes.
He has no say in the matter, not unless he wants to push this child out.
Clever girl, I think. Despite the slow encroachment of modern obstetrics into the realm of childbirth, it is still, thankfully, a woman's prerogative to decide who will deliver her child. Although I worry this too will change. Mrs. Ney appears unperturbed.
Dr. Page did not leave. He's keeping Mr. Robbins' company downstairs.
Eliza snorts.
With lit pipes, no doubt. They are attempting smoke rings. The sitting room will have to be aired out tomorrow.
Harvard men, Eliza shakes her head, always trying to act like Oxford men. She groans then, deep and guttural, and I spring from my chair to go stand behind the young woman to make sure she doesn't fall.
I'm fine, she says, voice thick with pain. It's just that this one,
I'm not sure why the girl is still standing. Most women, those in labor for the first time at least, refuse to walk the room after a certain point in labor. Eliza isn't in transition yet, but she is close, her water finally having broken an hour ago, and she paces before the window, hands on her lower back, wet footprints trailing behind her. She wears only a shift, and her fine brown hair is loose, curling against her damp forehead. With the warm glow from the hearth and the candles scattered about the room, she looks like something out of a Renaissance painting. Pink cheeks and round body. Every so often I tend a patient who makes the act of birth a thing of beauty. They make it look like what it really is at its most elemental, right and natural, and I cannot help but marvel. Eliza Robbins has no family in attendance, or at least none that are blood-related. Mrs. Ney, once her governess, now her housekeeper, has been friend and family since the girl was born in Manchester.
When Eliza married Chandler and moved first to Boston, then to Hollowell, the wiry sprite of a woman came as well, and is at ease in the delivery room as before the cook stove. It is not duty that brought Mrs. Ney here, but devotion. The woman, widowed young, has no children of her own. So it is Eliza she lives for, and soon the child she carries will inherit that devotion. Upon my arrival, Mrs. Ney assessed me head to foot and pronounced that I would do nicely. Eliza Robbins has not questioned my instructions once as a result. "May I ask why you sent Dr. Page away?" I ask. Eliza answers with another grunt, rounding her spine and grabbing onto the window sash for support. After 30 seconds, the contraction subsides, and she takes a long breath through her nose.
"Because Grace Sewell told me he is an idiot. She said he nearly killed her with all that laudanum. Said you were right about everything, but no one would listen, not even her."
Eliza finally makes her way to the bed, and we help her scoot back against the pillows. She sighs in relief.
"This might be my first child, Mistress Ballard, but I am the oldest of five myself, and I've seen several come into the world. Haven't I, Ney?"
"More'n enough.
Chandler and I tried for 2 years for this baby, and I don't want some clod of a doctor killing me before I can see it."
Chandler Robbins hails from Boston, as so many of the newer residents in Hollowell do, and like his friend David Sewell, is a Harvard graduate. But whereas Sewell set his sights on starting a business across the river, Robbins has, for the last several years, been methodically building a boatyard on the peninsular outcropping of Bumber Hook Point, a mile and a half south of the Hook. Like any good entrepreneur, he knows that profitable industry relies on raw materials, easy transportation, and ready energy. The Kennebec provides him all three. Hollowell and its booming lumber trade provide the rest. He owns the point and everything on it, but his home is in the Hook, on Water Street, overlooking the river. It sits on a rise and has been dubbed the Robin's Nest, no doubt a nod to both its elevated position and the crow's nest atop every ship that Chandler builds. For all his wealth and prominence, he chose a wife who, at first glance, seems below his station. Eliza is not pretty. She looks rather owlish with her big brown eyes and feathery hair, but what she lacks in appearance, she more than makes up for in heart and intellect. Having met her, it isn't hard to understand that Chandler, resourceful, practical, affluent, has chosen a partner and not just a wife. "Eliza," I warn, "I will have to touch you now to see how far along you are. Do what you must, but don't think less of me if I curse. My mother was French." And that is all it takes for me to like the young woman. Sometimes it is easy to bond with a patient. Sometimes it is impossible. Usually I don't bother myself either way because I have only one job in a birthing room. But the instant camaraderie does make that job easier, and I help Eliza scoot her shift up under her breasts. I can tell by the shape of her belly that the baby has dropped into the birth canal. "Ready?" I ask.
"No,"
Eliza laughs, then gasps as her stomach turns to a vise. My inspection will hurt less during a contraction, so I slide my hand into Eliza's body once the grinding pain reaches its peak. Inches. That's all it takes before I find what I'm looking for. "The head is down. Your baby is in position. Are you ready to push?" Those wide owl eyes fill with tears, but not of pain. Fear. It is the most natural emotion, and I grab her hand. "I am here. So is Mrs. Ney. You can do this, and we will help you. But on the next contraction, you must begin to push." And she does. Not hard or well. Eliza is tired and inexperienced and afraid. but for the next hour she bears down over and over and over, crying, panting, grunting, and swearing, but only once, and in French, an astonished merde, when the head, covered in thick black hair, pops from her body. 1.5 more pushes for the shoulders, and then I pull a slimy, wiggling baby boy from Eliza's body. "Hello, little one," I greet him as I do every child, but this time I laugh. He is enormous, easily 9 pounds. I roll him over, counting fingers, toes. I rub him down with a soft cloth, check his palate, his eyes. And when the afterbirth is delivered, I snip and tie the cord with a smooth, practiced movement. I set the boy gently on Eliza's chest so they can meet each other. He is bawling, loud little lungs shrieking his displeasure at all the light and noise. He does not like the air on his skin. He does not like being removed from his safe, warm home. But when Eliza says, "Thomas, hush now," he stops crying, and much to everyone's astonishment, lifts his head right off her chest and looks directly at his mother. And in that short silence, as we are speechless at the strength of this new little Robins, we can hear his stomach growl. I choke out a boggled sort of laugh. Mrs. Ney jumps into action then, plucking Thomas up with one arm and helping Eliza prepare to nurse with the other. "Let's get you a meal then, hungry boy." She looks at her young ward, beaming with pride, and says, "Your boy has arrived wanting meat and potatoes." The rest of my job is easy. There is no tearing, no excessive bleeding, only the bathing and changing, the wrapping of linen cloths and the disposal of afterbirth. I help Eliza get Thomas latched onto her breast. Then Mrs. Ney and I sit by the new mother and praise all her good work. We commend her on a beautiful baby. And once they are situated, Mrs. Ney slips away to prepare a simple cold meal for me and the famished new mother. It is well after sunset when I tell Eliza, "I will be back shortly," and I leave the room with the bucket of waste. "Will you ask Chandler to come up?" she calls after me. "Of course." I slip through the kitchen and out the back of the house to the privy. First, I relieve myself, then empty the bucket. "Leave that here," Mrs. Ney says, nodding toward the bucket. "When I come back inside, I'll wash it." I watch the older woman cut cheese and bread and thick slices of smoked ham. She pours milk, arranges shortbread, makes tea, clucks like a proud mother hen. "Eliza is lucky to have you," I say. There are tears in her eyes when she looks at me. "'Tis is the other way round. Her mother would be so proud of her." "Is she?" "Aye, not long ago. Past the year after Eliza married. A terrible shame. She was a good woman." "I'm sorry to hear that." I pat Mrs. Ney on the shoulder. "I'll go get Chandler." Dr. Page is passed out on his back on the chaise in the drawing room, one arm thrown over his face and a leg dangling off the side. There is an empty brandy snifter balanced on his chest, and it wobbles with each breath. He has no staying power, I think. Then I look at Chandler, also asleep, but sitting upright in his chair, head lolled to the side. The pipe still sits in his hand, curling gentle strands of smoke into the air. The men never do. I gently shake Chandler's shoulder, and he snorts awake. "You have a beautiful, healthy son," I whisper. He leaps up and is about to shout his joy, but I set a firm finger across his mouth, shake my head, and point to Dr. Page. I would rather not have to converse with the man again unless I have to, so I guide Chandler into the hall and close the drawing room door behind us. Eliza was magnificent. They're both resting upstairs. "A son!" He runs his hand through his hair. "What will we name him?" "Thomas, apparently. but if you disagree, you'd best tell your wife soon. She's been calling him that from the moment she saw his face.
Thomas.
He smiles, wide as the ocean. And then, as if realizing for the first time that he's still holding his pipe, puts it to his lips. He draws in a mouthful of smoke, then forms his mouth to make a ring. No such luck. The smoke comes out in a white ball, then dissipates. But he is undeterred.
Thomas it is.
Ever since being called to the Robinses this afternoon, I have wondered how I would broach this subject. There is no easy way, so I dive right in. May I ask you something, quickly, before you go up?
Of course.
It's a strange question, so bear with me.
All right.
You helped the others cut Joshua Burgess from the ice that morning, in November. He was found right off Bumberhook Point, near your boatyard.
Yes, he was. They came to me since the property's mine. There were seven of us who did the job. Eight, maybe, I can't remember. It was dark and cold, and it was months ago now.
And you were drunk by the time I got to the tavern, I think, but do not remind him. But you had lanterns that morning. You saw well enough to cut him out, to know who it was.
Yes.
I am careful, lowering my voice to a whisper in case Dr. Page has woken. And what did you think?
Same as you, Mistress Ballard. That he'd been hung. Seemed obvious enough. All of us thought so.
But there was no rope.
Only the one they pulled Sam Dalwyn out of the river with. But nothing near the body.
The sharp wail of a baby's cry interrupts us, and Chandler looks to the top of the stairs. Thank you, I say. Now go see your son. He turns away and is about to bound up the steps, but I grab his jacket just in time. Not with this, I tell him, and pluck the pipe from his hand. No smoking near the baby. Bad for his new lungs. Chandler runs up the steps, two at a time, and when he's out of sight, I put the pipe to my own lips and draw. Chandler's tobacco smells of cherries and chocolate. It is cased with molasses and topped with vanilla, but tastes, as all smoke does, like smoke. Only a nicer, classier kind of smoke. The kind you pay for. The kind that comes in little pouches and smells of gentlemen and scholars. Tobacco. There is no soot or ash, and I don't bother trying to blow a ring. I simply stand at the bottom of the stairs and let the cloud rise around my head as I ponder what Chandler has told me.
Give me that, Mrs. Ney says from behind me.
For one moment, I think the housekeeper is going to scold me. But instead, she adds,
you're doing it wrong.
Then the wiry, old, silver-haired woman puts the pipe to her lips, hollows her cheeks, pulls, puffs, and blows out a perfect smoke ring that grows and grows as it rises until, a foot wide, it dissipates altogether. Pollard's Tavern. As I pass the tavern on my way home, two drunken patrons stumble out, and I catch a full, warm whiff of Abigail's cooking. Mrs. Ney and I nibbled at dinner, but I'd had no appetite for the meal, knowing that Dr. Page was in the next room and would likely wake at any moment. I'm not in the mood to handle his abuse. So I'd left the happy family and headed home for my own bed. But this, the smell of a hearty meal, is all the motivation I need. The fire is blazing inside, and the lanterns burn bright. The room is only half full of guests, but overflowing with laughter. And I am met at the door by Moses. His cheeks are rosy and his smile wide.
Are you ill, Mistress Ballard?
He asks, taking one look at me.
No, I've just come from a delivery. I was on my way home when I smelled your mother's cooking.
Ah, let's get you some of it then. Fortify you for the ride.
I follow him to a table at the back and sink onto the bench with a groan.
This is a new thing I've discovered about myself in recent years. The noises. Stand and groan. Sit and grunt. Some days it seems that I can hardly take a step without some part of my body creaking or cracking. And this, even more than the gray hairs and the crow's feet at my eyes, makes me feel as though I am racing down the final stretch of middle age. Within moments, Moses sets a plate in front of me.
Cornish hen, roasted on the spit, along with carrots and onions and potatoes.
There is also a slab of generously buttered bread. Yet before I can even thank him, much less lift the fork to my mouth, he whispers,
"Did you hear about the Burgess homestead?"
"Hear what?" Moses looks to either side to see if anyone is listening, then drops to the bench across from me.
"I guess you wouldn't have, since you've been at a birth all day."
He clearly wants to tell me the news, but I am famished, so I take a bite of potato while he backs into his story. Oh God, it is even tastier than I remember. I will never understand how Abigail Pollard can make the same meal that I do, and yet it is always 10 times better. I'm able to sneak in another bite before he continues.
"Someone burned Joshua Burgess's home to the ground earlier this month, but it was only discovered this morning."
It's a wonder I don't choke.
"Why?"
"Dead men don't get many visitors, I suppose. But a pair of trappers mentioned it at breakfast. My Da thinks that's where Judge North hid after the hearing, but only for a few days, just long enough to ride out the storm."
I sit a little straighter.
"Why not longer?"
"It's been burned for several weeks."
"So how does he know it was North?"
"The barn didn't burn, and it was littered with dog prints. That's where Da thinks he kept Cicero."
"He didn't take the dog with him?"
Moses shakes his head. "I saw it on the porch at North Manor this afternoon. Must have taken it home before he left town for good. But honestly, it was clever of North to hide there. Burgess is dead. No one would look there."
It's a good point, and I tell him so.
"But why burn it?" I ask. "It makes no sense to destroy an empty house." "Unless there was something in the house that he wanted gone."
He shrugs, then stands to go back to work. He may as well have slapped me with his bare hand.
"Moses," I ask, "what happened to Burgess's belongings?" "He didn't have much to start with. One horse, 2 cows, some chickens. And the cabin was only just the one room, from what I've heard. There wasn't much in it. The animals were given to the neighbors when he died."
I tear off a piece of bread, then pop it in my mouth. I chew slowly as a dozen little fires ignite in my mind.
"What of his saddle, his weapons? Were there any personal items?"
"Da put them in the shed.
With him."
Moses shrugs.
"Henry Sewell sent a letter to Boston looking for his relatives. Hasn't heard back, far as I know."
"You'll let me know if you hear anything else?"
"Aye. I'll send word."
"Or you can bring it yourself. I'm sure Hannah would be pleased to see you again." There are few things that I enjoy more than making a young man blush, and Moses obliges me in spectacular fashion.
"Aye, I'll do that," he says. "Can I get you anything else in the meantime?"
It's a risk, I know this, but I should have thought of it months ago.
"Yes," I tell Moses. "I'm going to need a lantern."
The Pollards call it a shed, but the structure behind the tavern is more like a small barn. Though only one story, it has double doors and could easily house several head of cattle comfortably. They use it to store extra supplies and feed for barrels and crates. Also, the body of Joshua Burgess. The path isn't as well worn as others near the tavern, the stables in particular. But it's clear that someone makes the trip regularly. So my visit shouldn't be noticeable in the morning if Amos comes out to collect a side of beef or a slab of bacon. The door latch creaks as I lift, then it flops over with a thump. I look back over my shoulder to see if anyone has heard. No lights go on in the upper windows of the tavern. No voices call out. So I pull the door open and slip inside. The shed is well ordered. Foodstuffs and supplies stacked in neat rows that are accessible on either side. 6 large sides of beef and 10 ham hocks hang from the ceiling. There are bags of wheat and wheels of cheese. I hold my breath for several seconds before realizing that the expected scents of death and decay are not noticeable. The shed smells only of hay and salt and sawdust, of dried apples and smoked fish. But it is cold as river rocks inside, and everything is frozen. At first, I cannot find the body, am worried that it has been moved or stolen. But then, in the back corner, I see the pile of hay. It makes sense. Even if you know it's there, you don't want to stumble upon a corpse every time you come out for a tub of butter. They have hidden Burgess out of sight. Satisfied, I close the door behind me. I can see footprints on the dusty floor and scattered hay where the judges from Vassalboro stood around and inspected the body a few weeks ago. It has since been heaped back over the body in a sloppy pile. I set the lantern down and push through the hay with the toe of my boot until the oiled leather tarp that covers Burgess comes into view. I have no interest in examining him again. Once was more than enough. So I move in the other direction, kneeling now, and scooting piles of the dry chaff aside with my hands. There, the swell of a saddle. I push the straw back and find all the tack in place. Blanket and bridle, bit and reins. I cover it again and keep searching. Beside it is a woolen blanket wrapped around a rifle and hatchet. Not what I'm looking for. I move on, sliding my arms in now, up to the shoulders as I feel my way farther into the pile. Finally! My fingers slide over the leather strap of a saddlebag, and I pull it from the hay. It is dusty and cold and heavy. The night presses in around the circle of the lantern light, and my heart ticks faster. This is wrong, I know that, but I unbuckle the bag anyway. Inside are Burgess's pistols, along with a coin purse that sits heavy in my hand when I pull it out, an empty bottle that smells of whiskey, 3 envelopes, and there, at the bottom of the bag, a strip of lace. I stare at it, aghast, remembering what Rebecca told the court, how Burgess ripped a piece of lace from the hem of her shift and tied his hair back before he went to work on her. He kept it, a souvenir, and my stomach turns at the sight. I pull each of the envelopes from the bag, squinting curiously at the broken wax seals and the return addresses written above them. The first reads, Colonel Joseph North, Hollowell, District of Maine. The second reads, The Kennebec Proprietors, Boston, Massachusetts. But it's the third that has me pinching my brows together in confusion. What in Satan's hell? I mutter, running the pad of my thumb over the familiar, elegant handwriting. It reads, Ephraim Ballard, Hollowell, District of Maine. I am turning the flap to open this last letter when I hear the loud thud of a door being slammed, then a mumbled curse, and the heavy clomp of footsteps stomping toward the shed. I shove everything back in the saddlebag and blow out the lantern. If light can explode, then darkness can swallow, and I am consumed in an instant. Dumb fool of a boy, growls the rough, guttural voice of Amos Pollard, followed by what I can only guess is a string of German profanity. Arschgeiger, Arschbit Ohren, Dunbretbohrer, Kutzbrocken. And then there is the loud creak of the latch being lifted, followed by the thump of it dropping into place across the door. Before I can call out or warn him that I am inside, Amos Pollard has stomped away, still cursing under his breath. I ease my way to the front of the shed and push against the door with my shoulder. It does not budge. I am locked inside. You are a fool, Martha Ballard, I say, and my voice sounds hollow in the darkness. Of all the professions you could have chosen, you found the one, the only damned one, that would get you locked up with a dead man in the middle of the night.
30 years ago. Oxford, Massachusetts. February 28, 1760.
I don't know a thing about delivering babies, I told the boy. He couldn't have been 10 years old, but still he looked at me as though I was a simpleton.
You got one on your hip and another inside the house. You must know something about it.
That's different from delivering someone else's, I said. And besides, are you sure she meant me? The boy groaned, rolled his eyes.
You Mistress Ballard, ain't you?
Yes.
Then use who she meant.
Said she wants your help and wants you to come quick. Impatient, he shifted from foot to foot.
Well, you coming?
I looked to where my husband sat at the table, watching Cyrus eat a bowl of mush. He was 3 1/2 and handy with a spoon, but when left unattended, liked to finger paint with his meals. The look I sent to Ephraim plainly said, rescue me, but he didn't.
You should go, he said. I will stay with the children.
But
go.
I could be gone a long time.
They will be fine, seeing as how I've been a parent as long as you have. Go help Elspeth.
The woman in question, one Elspeth Horn, was a terrifying old midwife, wizened and angry, but fiercely competent in the birthing room. That's why I'd sought her out when I had Cyrus, and then later Lucy. But I could not fathom why she'd sent the boy for me. Ephraim rose from the table and reached for Lucy. She dove into his arms with a wild giggle, and he plopped her on his shoulder like a sack of grain.
Go.
There was nothing left to argue. Lucy was weaned, after all, and I couldn't use that as an excuse. So I kissed Ephraim, grabbed my coat, slipped on my gloves, and followed the boy at a brisk walk down the path and onto the snow-packed road toward Oxford. The tavern where we were headed was only a mile away, and we made easy work of the distance, what with my long stride and his quick steps. All the boy would tell me was that the woman laboring had been staying at the tavern for a week and that he'd been sent to fetch me. He didn't know her name or how long she'd been in labor. When we arrived, he darted to the stairs, looked back, and waved for me to follow. Up, up we went, all the way to the attic room, and every step I mounted left me feeling more of an idiot for being there in the first place. By the time we reached the short, slanted door, I'd convinced myself to turn around and go home. But the boy threw it open without knocking, ran to the old woman seated by the bed, and kissed her on the cheek.
Here she is, Gran.
Thank you, Walter. Now go wait on the stairs in case I need you again. I watched him go, then turned to Elspeth. With one old, gnarled hand, she stroked the arm of a girl who lay on the bed, her huge, rounded stomach pointing to the ceiling. The girl looked every bit as alarmed at my presence as I felt.
Mistress Ballard? Elspeth asked,
and I realized I'd not said a word since entering the room.
Yes?
She turned at the sound of my voice, and suddenly I understood. I'd not seen Elspeth in 18 months. And her eyes had been dark then, darker than mine. But they'd turned a total milky white since. Elspeth Horn was blind.
Come in, she said, and take off your coat. You'll need your arms free.
I will.
Get on with it. You're letting in a draft.
I shut the door, shrugged out of my cloak, and peeled off my gloves. Then I took a deep breath and went to stand beside her. I told her the truth.
I don't understand why you called for me.
You are going to help me deliver this child.
The girl was plenty young. She still had the full round face of adolescence. and the scared look of a child. She didn't wear a wedding ring, but that didn't mean much, as half the men I knew were too poor to give one to their wives.
"Has she no women?" I asked.
"She won't say, one way or another. But then she hasn't said much to begin with. No one knows where she came from or where she's going, only that she showed up Wednesday last and has plenty of coin to pay for her room. The innkeeper called for me early this morning when he heard her crying, rightly assumed her pains had begun. Walter got me here, but he's no use otherwise. So it's the two of us who will get the job done." She paused, nodded toward the light. "There should be another chair somewhere in the room. If not, send Walter to get one from downstairs."
There was one beside the window. I grabbed it and joined her beside the bed.
"Why me?" Elspeth pushed a long silver ribbon of hair away from her forehead, but it flopped forward again, and absentmindedly I reached out and tucked it behind her ear. She felt the gesture, tilted her head, looked at me without seeing.
"Because you don't panic in a birthing room. You didn't with Cyrus, and that was as hard a birth as any I've ever seen. Nor did you with Lucy. And if I'm going to teach what I know, then I want it to be someone not given to hysterics. Ain't nothing worse than a screamer or a crier or a silly girl in a room like this."
An hour ago, I was eating lunch with my little family, and now I'd just been told that, without my knowledge or approval, I'd become apprenticed to this woman. The girl lay there, looking back and forth between Elspeth and me, as though she wanted to stand up and run. But there'd be no running for her, not for a long while, because I could see the first hard wave of pain wash over her. The groan that followed was familiar, and I winced in sympathy. I was almost 22 when I had Cyrus, but this girl couldn't be 17. I reached forward and set a hand on her belly, feeling it harden. "I am sorry that you don't have anyone with you for this," I told her. "But I've done it twice, and there is no better midwife in the state than Elspeth. We will help you."
"She's blind," the girl hissed.
"She has my eyes for seeing, and her hands work just fine. There's no need to worry." Elspeth patted my knee, and I knew I'd said the right thing.
"What do you need me to do?" I asked.
"Ask her name."
Elspeth must have sensed my confusion, because she added, "The first thing, the most important thing in a birthing room, is to ask the woman's name. If you mean to put your hands on her body, she must trust you. And she will never do that if you don't even know what to call her, because you will be doing a great deal more than simply putting your hands on her by the end."
"My name is Martha Ballard," I said to the girl. I felt silly, like a child standing before a cranky teacher, but I did it anyway. "What is yours?"
I could see her debate, as though saying it aloud would be a total surrender to our care. But another contraction hit her, this one worse than the last. And when it ebbed several seconds later, she said,
"Trephine. My name is Trephine Hartwell."
Elspeth nodded.
"Good. Now hand me my medical bag. It's at the foot of the bed. I will tell you what every item is for, and you will do with them exactly as I say. And Martha."
"Yes?"
"By the end of this night, you will know whether midwifery is a thing to which you have been called."
Those pale, watery eyes bored into me.
"Or not."
5. The Grief That Does Not Speak. March 1790. If you have tears, prepare to shed them now. William Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. Ballard's Mill,
Monday, March 1. I finish yesterday's journal entry while Ephraim reads the letters. There are three in total, one of them in his own handwriting. And I can hear the papers crinkle between his fingers as I record the details of Eliza Robbins's delivery in my journal. Sunday, February 28. Birth. Chandler Robbins's son. Snowed in the afternoon. I was called to see Mrs. Robbins, who was unwell. Mrs. Robbins lingered until 4 p.m. when her illness came on. Dr. Page was called, but she did not wish to see him when he came. She was safe delivered of a son, her firstborn, at the 10th and one-half hour last evening, and is as well as can be expected. I tarried and watched. Mrs. Ney was there, and she only. I'd recognized Ephraim's writing on the envelope, of course. There was no mistaking the precise and lovely lines. How the stem of every D curls up and to the left, making a perfect half-loop above the letter. The only mystery is how a survey that my husband completed almost 12 years ago had come to be in the saddlebag of a dead man. Ephraim wanted the entire story, of course, where I'd been and what I'd been up to, not to mention how I got out of that shed. He wanted it the moment I got home, but exhausted and stiff, I'd promised to give him every detail if he would wait until the morning. Now I tap my quill on the little pewter dish to knock off the remaining ink and push my journal aside. I turn to Ephraim. Wait.
But...
Ephraim drops the letter to his lap and looks up at me, staggered.
This says...
I know what it says.
They can't.
They can, apparently, with that affidavit from North. Ephraim folds each letter methodically and places it back in its envelope. Bits of wax seal break off and fall to the floor, but he doesn't notice. He taps the letters against his thigh. Then he's up and pacing.
This is an eviction notice.
Yes, I read it. And I had. After dressing this morning, but before leaving our room, I sat on the edge of the bed and read each of the letters in Burgess's saddlebag. A survey drawn almost 12 years ago by Ephraim of our 80 acres, along with a detailed property description. A certified letter to the Kennebec proprietors from Joseph North, stating that the Ballard family had failed to meet the third condition for acquiring the deed to this property, and a response from said proprietors noting that the Ballard lease is heretofore canceled and, as North suggested, reassigned to one Captain Joshua Burgess. The fact that the saddlebag came home with me last night is another thing I will have to explain to my husband. He hasn't asked yet. Therefore, I haven't volunteered.
But it's a lie. Everything he said in that letter is demonstrably false. We have met every condition.
Not the third, not technically.
Only because next month will mark our 12th year on this property. But we have most certainly maintained a permanent residence. There are hundreds of people who will testify to that.
Will that matter if North refuses to certify the claim? He is the Kennebec proprietor, not you. And it would require a lengthy appeal regardless. And in the meantime, we would have been evicted, turned into the street so Burgess could have all we've built.
Except he's dead, and we are still here.
I shake my head. That's the part I don't understand. Why would North go to all the trouble of transferring the mill to Burgess only to kill him? He looks at me with those steely blue eyes.
You believe it was North?
It's the only thing that makes sense. He's the only one to profit from Burgess's death. Ephraim goes to stand before the window, the letters pinched between two fingers on his left hand. His back is straight and strong, as is his profile, and I watch him stare into the distance. After a moment, he scratches at the scruff along his jawline. A thought occurs to me, and I sit up straighter on the stool.
Oh. What?
When is North's letter dated?
He pulls it from the envelope, holds it at arm's length, gives it a myopic squint.
October 1st, why?
The date is familiar. So I reach for my journal and flip back to October 1st, looking for a clue. And there it is, in black and white, written by my own hand. Thursday, October 1. Clear, except some showers. We had company this afternoon. Mr. Savage here informs us that Mrs. Foster has sworn a rape on a number of men, among whom is Joseph North. Shocking indeed. I have been at home. That was the day that Rebecca Foster came forward with her accusation of rape.
What are you saying?
I think North was buying Joshua Burgess's silence with this property.
So why kill him?
It's a valid question. One that I can't answer with any degree of certainty. I don't know. Not yet, at any rate.
All your scheming hasn't produced a solution.
I do not scheme.
If that were the case, you wouldn't have found yourself locked in the Pollard shed in the middle of the night, or come home with a saddlebag that does not belong to you.
Ephraim leans against the wall, gives me a stern look.
Do not think I have not forgotten simply because of,
he holds up the letters,
these.
I take a deep breath, puff it out. I did think I was in trouble for a moment. It had gotten as cold as a well digger's arse in there, and I couldn't decide whether or not to call for help.
Intrigued by the idea of freezing to death, were you?
I glare at him. It hadn't gotten to that point. And besides, I had no way of explaining what I was doing there or why I had that damn saddlebag over my arm.
Well, I'm guessing you didn't walk through the wall or dig your way out, so who rescued you?
Moses, I laugh. Amos had gone back in and flayed him in German for leaving the shed door unlocked. Didn't take him long to figure out where I'd gone with that lantern. It did, however, take him a while to come for me. He had to wait until his father fell asleep. Ephraim runs his fingers through the hair at his temples, shakes his head, growls.
You will be the death of me, woman.
All's well that ends well. He does not think it funny, this use of the bard against him, and his eyes thin to slits of irritation. I would have got out. Eventually,
I say. Maybe. Maybe not. But I see you have not solved our current predicament,
which is
how, in the name of seven hells, we are going to explain how you came to be in possession of that saddlebag.
No one is asking that particular question just yet.
They will, the moment we go public with these letters, which we'll have to do because, technically, we no longer have a legal right to live on this property.
I'm about to tell him that by the time anyone thinks to ask that question, we'll have figured out a way to answer. But that's when Jonathan throws back the door to my workroom without knocking.
Yes? Ephraim asks.
Jonathan looks at his father with pity and dread.
Something has killed Percy.
The wooden slats have been torn apart, and there is blood on the floor. A riot of feathers litter the mews. It is a grim scene, not much different from the block I use to butcher chickens. I watch Ephraim. He stands still, too still, as he takes in the sight.
What was it?
Jonathan asks. Ephraim steps back and inspects the ground. There are paw prints in the snow, a mad tangle of them, crisscrossing and mashed together.
A coyote, he says. Not a wolf? Those are big tracks. It was a big coyote.
He kneels and draws one finger along the print.
See, the toes are oblong and the pad is scalloped. A wolf has round toes, an angular pad. I'm sorry, Jonathan says. It's a shame to lose that bird.
Ephraim grunts but doesn't answer immediately. Instead, he walks around the mews, hunched over, until he finds a set of prints leading into the forest. These are wider apart, like the animal was running, and there are small drops of blood spattered between them. To me, it looks as though the coyote ran off with Percy between his jaws, but Ephraim returns, shaking his head.
I don't think he's dead. Dad, are you?
Jonathan's voice trails off when I shake my head. Let him be, my expression says.
If it got him, it would have torn Percy apart right here.
He points to the ground in front of the mews. There are a lot of feathers, I say.
It got into the mews, took a few swipes, no doubt. But I think Percy got his licks in, scared the thing, and flew away.
We all three look to the sky, as though the falcon might be circling above us. Will he come back? I ask. Ephraim is less sure about this, and a frown clouds his expression.
I suppose we'll see how well I've trained him.
Pollard's Tavern, Friday, March 5. James Wall gives Brutus a longing glance as I tie up at the post beside the nag he's bought to replace his pacer. I recognize that look. It's a kind of longing mixed with jealousy, the sort of gaze an unhappy husband would settle on another man's wife. He scratches the long bridge of Brutus's nose.
You're still riding this beast?
Why wouldn't I?
He's a lot of horse.
And you think he's too much for me? James won't dare answer that question aloud, so he clears his throat, looks at the ground, grins. Well, you're not alone. My husband believes Brutus to be a villain as great as his namesake.
Yet he allows you to ride him?
Allows? I laugh. I am 54 years old. Ephraim doesn't allow me anything. I do as I please.
Well, if you ever decide to sell him, I'd like the chance to make an offer.
I know for a fact that James cannot afford this horse, but his suggestion is the opening I need. It's the entire reason I crossed the street when I saw him dismount in front of the tavern. So I follow him up the steps, and he holds the door open for me. I thought you only rode pacers.
I prefer them, no question, but I'm not as picky as people think.
He scowls over his shoulder at the nag,
as evidenced by that bag of bones.
We shrug out of hats and coats, stomp the snow off our feet. It's mid-afternoon and the sun is shining, but it's dim inside the tavern, and it takes a moment for our eyes to adjust. Are you drinking or visiting this afternoon? I ask.
Drinking. I'm not much in the way of company these days.
Oh, I doubt that. Let me buy you a pint. Consider it a consolation prize for having to ride that old plug out there. James laughs, and Moses is there, ready to take our orders by the time we found our seats. Then he's off to get our ale and cider, cheerful and efficient as always while we settle in. I am sorry that you had to sell your horse, I tell James. He frowns.
I knew better than to go to Joseph North for a loan.
Then why did you?
I ain't proud of it, but it happened before that business with Mistress Foster. I would have never.
Moses is back, and he plunks two mugs onto the table. They're both overfilled, and foam dribbles over the rim as the rich amber liquid spills onto the table. James drinks his down to a manageable level as he waits for Moses to wander off again.
Point is, North had the cash and the willingness to invest. Went on and on about how we need a distillery in the Hook. And the terms seemed good. I had no trouble making the payments until the river froze.
Most families make their own home brew. And while the quality of the beer varies, it isn't an arduous task. Same for cider. The barrels used to ferment them are often harder to come by than the ingredients. But liquor is another story. All the rum, gin, and whiskey consumed in the Hook is shipped in from elsewhere. James is smart to recognize that need and try to meet it. Even I can't fault him for taking the financial risk. After all, last summer, North was just another businessman willing to invest in local commerce. You didn't have anything saved to cover the loan during the winter months?
Not enough to pay it in full. which is what North demanded, even though that's not what he really wanted.
What do you mean?
He gave me two options when I went to him and said my December payment would be short. Said I could pay the entire loan, plus interest, in full right then, or sign over a portion of the distillery to him.
But you've only just started construction.
He scowls into his ale. North said it was his way of investing in the business. But what he really wanted was 30% off the top. James can tell by my expression that I am outraged on his behalf. I refused, of course. Ended up in the jail yard and had to sell my pacer to get out from under his thumb.
30% is outrageous.
That's North. Don't you see what he's doing?
I shake my head.
He wants to own the entire town.
Ballard's Mill. Sunday, March 7.
Well done, I say.
Sarah White beams at me across the table. Between us is the New England primer and three sheets of loose paper, along with my quill and ink. Sarah's letters are clear and straight, not at all like a child's, and they only slant downward slightly as they go across the page. She has successfully written her name, along with those of her parents and her daughter. Sarah has taken great care with this last. C-H-A-R-L-O-T-T-E, spelled out in capital letters. She is proud of the name and the child. I can tell you've been practicing. This is our second lesson, the first having commenced last month when I extended my offer and left the primer in her possession. I am hoping to draw this one out long enough that she will stay and join us for lunch.
Every night, Sarah tells me, it's not as hard as I thought it would be. Not once I memorize the sounds. And the pictures help.
Her face fills with color, and I think she is embarrassed.
I know that's silly.
I set my palm over the back of Sarah's hand.
Not at all. That's what the pictures are for.
At first, Sarah balked at doing this lesson in front of Hannah and Dolly. It was a dose of humble pie she had not intended to consume before an audience. But my girls, having learned to read at my knee as well, are delighted to have Sarah at our table, and they take turns playing with Charlotte while she does the lesson. Dolly comes to stand behind Sarah and peers over her shoulder at the primer. The pictures were always my favorite part. I still want a nice illustration every now and again when I read. She pats Sarah's shoulder, then wanders off again to knead the bread that is finished rising.
Hannah, I ask.
She looks up.
Will you go tell Cyrus and your father that lunch is almost ready?
I'll tell father, she says. But Cyrus is gone. He rode off not 5 minutes ago.
Damn it, I think.
Where did he go?
Hannah shrugs.
On some errand for father.
I stifle a sigh.
This is the best chance I've had to get Sarah and Cyrus in a room together in over a month. His confinement to the jail yard complicates that, of course, given that he's home only during daylight hours. Having Sarah do her lesson here had seemed the perfect solution. I turn back to Sarah and tap a small square on the left side of the page. Inside is a simply drawn hourglass with flowers in the corner. Let's try one more page before lunch. Start here. Sarah furrows her brow, and I see her lips working to sound out the letters before she speaks.
As runs the glass, man's life doth pass.
Excellent. Now the next.
My book and here.
No, heart. It says heart.
My book and heart shall never part.
The pictures help, but so does the rhyming. And the farther we go down the page, the more comfortable Sarah feels reading the words aloud. It isn't just the writing she's been practicing every night, but the reading as well.
and in the absence of shame, this new skill begins to bloom. I sit back, pleased, as Sarah continues without my prompting. The lion bold, the lamb doth hold. The moon gives light in time of night. Night in nightingales. Nightingales sing in time of spring. On we go for the rest of the page, and when I look up, I see my daughters watching with expressions of pride. They are proud of Sarah. They like her. And the girl could do worse than marrying into a family in which she is liked. I only have to figure out a way to make it happen, a way to make Cyrus stay put long enough to try. When lunch has been consumed and Sarah has bundled herself against the cold and tucked Charlotte into a sling beneath her coat, I see them both to the door, then watch as Jonathan bundles them onto the wagon. Once they're gone, I go back to the fire and sit beside my husband. He's nursing a glass of brandy and barely hiding a smile.
"Why the sour look, love? Have you been thwarted?" he asks.
"You warned Cyrus off, didn't you?"
"I sent him on an errand. We still have a business to run, despite your schemes."
"Last I heard, you liked this scheme."
"I do, but it still has to be her idea."
"Well, now she's gone off with Jonathan."
Ephraim shrugs. "He could do worse."
I swipe his glass and take a sip of the brandy. No, Jonathan is the last thing Sarah needs. He's going to find himself in a great deal of trouble if he doesn't stop bedding girls before he marries one. That shocks him at least, and I'm glad to have his full attention.
You're certain he and Sally have...
More a suspicion than a certainty. I tip the last of his brandy into my mouth and swallow. But it's going to end badly for that boy of yours, mark my words.
He's mine now, is he?
When they cause trouble, they're yours. I stand and head toward my workroom, but Ephraim grabs my wrist.
Look, he says.
He leads me to the window. A long, dark shadow flies out of the woods, 50 feet above the ground. It circles the mill once, then comes to rest on the weather vane. Ephraim was right. Percy is alive.